Hello and welcome to Introduction to Meteorology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa with Dr. Jennifer Griswold. Thanks for joining us. In today's lecture, we're going to talk about global wind patterns such as the Hadley, Ferrell, and Polar Cells, jet streams, westerlies, trade winds, and even El Nino. In preparation for today's lecture, you should have read through the second half of Chapter 7 from the Aaron's text. Last lecture, we talked about local wind systems, like sea and land breezes, as well as mountain, valley, Chinook, Katabatic, Santa Ana, Haboobs, and monsoons. Today, we're going to go into detail about the three-cell model of the atmosphere and discuss the wind and pressure systems associated with it. We'll address the fast-moving bands of wind in the upper atmosphere known as jet streams and discuss how they interact with weather. We'll also talk about the connections between the atmospheric circulation and ocean currents. Let's talk about what we call global circulation, the largest scale patterns of movement for the atmosphere. The simplest model for the atmosphere is the single cell model, in which solar energy is the driver of the winds, but doesn't include the rotation of the Earth. Without rotation, there's no Coriolis effect, and we end up having a simplistic pattern of rising air at the equator and sinking air at the poles, with the general movement of air at the surface, from the poles, where there's a high pressure, to the equator, where there's a low pressure. In the upper atmosphere, the air would travel from the equator to the poles. This, of course, is not how the real atmosphere works because the Earth does rotate at 15 degrees per hour. If we take the rotation of the Earth into account, we end up with what is called the three-cell model. It was proposed in the 1920s and includes, as the name implies, three cells in each hemisphere. One cell is located between the equator and 30 degrees north or 30 degrees south and is called the Hadley cell. The Ferrell cell is found between 30 degrees north and 60 degrees north, or 30 degrees south and 60 degrees south. The third cell is the polar cell and is found between 60 degrees north and the North Pole at 90 degrees north, and between 60 degrees south and the South Pole at 90 degrees south. Let's talk about each of these cells separately. We'll focus on the cells in the Northern Hemisphere for the rest of the lecture. We'll address the Northern Hemisphere, but all the information can be applied to the South. The Hadley cell is found between the equator and 30 degrees north, or 30 degrees south. Air rises at the equator and travels north in the upper atmosphere and subsides between 25 and 30 degrees. 25 to 30 degrees north are known as the horse latitudes, and we'll discuss why in a few slides. From the center of the horse latitudes, the surface flow splits into two different winds, the trade wind, which travels equatorward, and the westerlies that head towards the poles. Their direction is influenced by the Coriolis effect and the rotation of the Earth. We have a special name for where the two trade winds meet along the equator, one from the North Hemisphere Hadley cell and one from the Southern Hemisphere Hadley cell. It is known as the doldrums due to the light winds and humid conditions. The Ferrell cell is found between 30 north and 60 north, or the same latitudes in the Southern Hemisphere. This cell is more complicated than the Hadley cell. The net surface flow is toward the poles while the Coriolis force bends the winds to the west. Thus, they are called the westerlies and blow from west to east. They are more sporadic and less reliable than the trade winds. The migration of cyclones and anticyclones disrupts the general westerly flow, but can also steer mid-latitude cyclones and tropical cyclones. The polar cell is found between 60 and 90 north, or the same latitudes in the Southern Hemisphere. In this cell, subsidence at the poles produces a surface flow that moves equatorward and is deflected by the Coriolis into the polar easterlies. As cold air moves equatorward, it meets with the warmer westerly flow and clashes. This difference in temperature between the warm westerlies and the polar easterlies results in the formation of the polar front. We'll talk a lot about the polar front and other fronts in general in future lectures. Let's go back for a moment and talk about the horse latitudes, since they are tied to an interesting legend. Remember, the horse latitudes are found between 25 and 30 north and south. In this region, the trade winds weaken. In the early days of ocean exploration, this would stall ships sailing to the New World. When particular areas were too calm, they were forced to toss over their frightened horses into the sea or eat them. In addition, the legend says that the horses would swim after the ships for miles before they drowned, and the superstitious sailors would hear the horses' screams in their haunted dreams for the rest of the voyage. Another likely and documented explanation is that the term is derived from the dead horse ritual of seamen, also see beating a dead horse as a phrase. In this practice, the seamen paraded a straw-stuffed effigy of a horse around on the deck before throwing it overboard. Seamen were paid partly in advance before a long voyage, and they frequently spent their pay all at once, resulting in a period of time without income. If they got advances from the ship's paymaster, they would incur debt. This period was called the dead horse time, and it usually lasted a month or two. The seaman's ceremony was to celebrate having worked off the dead horse debt, as westbound shipping from Europe usually reached the subtropics at about the time the dead horse was worked off. The latitude became associated with the ceremony. The next global scale winds we're going to talk about are trade winds. These are very important and common in Hawaii and in other locations around the globe for travel and commerce. In Hawaii, they are felt 83 to 95% of the time in the summer and 42 to 60% of the time in the winter. Trade winds are formed by warm air rising near the equator that moves northwards in the upper atmosphere as part of the Hadley cell. The airflow sinks back to the surface at 30 north or 30 south and flows back over the surface towards the equator, creating the wind we know as the trade winds. The name does not necessarily derive from what you'd expect. The term trade winds originally derived from the early 14th century late Middle English word trade, meaning path or track. The Portuguese recognized the importance of the trade winds in navigation in the Atlantic Ocean as early as the 15th century. They learned in order to reach South Africa, they needed to go far out in the ocean, head for Brazil and around 30 south, and go east again. By the 18th century, the importance of the trade winds to England's merchant fleet for crossing the Atlantic Ocean had led both the general public and etymologists to identify the name with the larger meaning of trade or foreign commerce. Let's move on to the westerlies. The westerlies occur between 30 and 60 north or south, and they essentially blow from high pressure air in the horse latitudes towards the poles. They are responsible for steering extratropical cyclones and can redirect tropical storms. The westerlies are the strongest in the winter hemisphere and at times when the pressure is lower over the poles. They are weakest in the summer hemisphere and when pressures are higher over the poles. The strongest westerly winds in the middle latitudes can be found in the region known as the Roaring Forties, between 40 and 50 south latitude. The Roaring Forties are strong west-to-east air currents caused by the combination of air being displaced from the equator towards the south pole. The Earth's rotation and the fact that there are few land masses to serve as windbreaks keeps the wind speeds high. While we're on the topic of intense winds, I'd like to give you the next extra credit fact that will appear in the midterm. The fastest wind recorded were a 1999 tornado at 318 miles per hour. So far, we've been talking about how the air moves horizontally and vertically on a global scale. We can also talk about the observed distribution of pressure and how it relates to wind. We can talk about lows and highs. Let's start with the equatorial low. These semi-permanent low-pressure systems are found near the equator, where the warm rising branch of the Hadley cell is located. This ascending moist air is warm and is related to cloud formation and precipitation near the equator. It is also referred to as the Intertropical Convergence Zone, or ITCZ. Next, we have subtropical highs. These are found between 25 and 40 north or south, where the westerlies and the trade winds originate due to subsidence or sinking of air from aloft. The winds that originate from these subtropical highs are caused mainly by the Coriolis deflection. The subtropical highs are also associated with Earth's major deserts, since subsiding air is likely to produce no clouds and no precipitation. Another type of low are subpolar lows. These are low-pressure regions between 50 or 60 north and south, corresponding to the location of the polar front, where the westerlies collide with the polar easterlies. These lows are responsible for much of the stormy weather in the mid-latitudes. As a general guide, you can think of the mid-latitudes of the continental U.S., from the Canadian boundary to the Mexican boundary. At the poles, we find the polar highs. These are where the polar easterlies originate. The high pressure develops over the cold polar areas due to extreme surface cooling and subsidence from the air sinking from above after being part of the feral cell. Now that we've addressed the wind patterns and semi-permanent pressure systems, let's talk about one of the results of the collision of warm and cold air masses as it travels in the three-cell model. When two very different temperature air masses collide, you have a steep temperature and pressure gradient and can produce a jet stream. A jet stream is a region of the upper atmosphere where a narrow band of air travels really fast. The location of the jet stream influences local weather and is related to large temperature contrast between the air in the feral and polar cells. Wind speeds in the jet stream range from an average of 75 miles per hour in the northern hemisphere winter to 35 to 40 in the northern hemisphere summer. They can exceed 300 miles per hour or more. The jet streams are found at a height of around 10 to 14 kilometers above the surface, though they can occur higher or lower. The best way to imagine the location of a jet stream is the boundary or collision between a warm and cold air mass. There are different jet streams. The first we'll talk about is the polar jet stream, which is also known as the mid-latitude jet stream. This occurs where the polar front is located, where the cold polar easterlies interact with the warm westerlies. It's a geostrophic wind, which means the wind flows parallel to the isobars and is only affected by the pressure gradient force and Coriolis force, and not friction, since it's so high up in the atmosphere. The polar jet meanders west to east and is stronger in the winter than the summer. The second jet stream is a subtropical jet stream. This is a semi-permanent jet stream that exists over the subtropics. It is mainly a wintertime phenomenon. Due to the weak summertime temperature gradient, the subtropical jet is relatively weak during the summer. It is much slower than the polar jet, but still travels west to east, usually about 25 north at an altitude of 13 kilometers, though it can shift in both of these respects. We've just completed a discussion of the global wind and pressure systems and discussed the jet streams in the upper atmosphere. Let's move on to how global winds and currents are related to ocean and atmosphere linkages. Winds are the driving force for ocean currents, and a clear relationship exists between ocean and atmospheric circulation. Two main differences are that the oceans, being more dense than air, move much slower than the atmosphere, and that the oceans have to contend with continents that block their path and confine the water to specific basins. We can see the effect by comparing the flow of the trade winds in the westerlies in the Atlantic Ocean to the direction of the currents along the equator, the Gulf Stream, the North Atlantic Drift, and the Canary Currents that move equatorward. These currents travel clockwise, mirroring the atmospheric motions above. Similar patterns can be observed in the other basins. The North Pacific Gyre is formed due to the influence of the trade winds in the westerlies. The resulting currents include the westward-flowing North Equatorial Current, the northward Kuroshio Current along Japan, the eastward-flowing North Pacific Current, and the south-flowing California Current. The North Pacific Gyre is interesting for another reason that has to do with humans and our plastic trash. What I'm talking about is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, or Trash Vortex. This is an area of marine debris at approximately 135 to 155 west and 35 to 42 north, although it shifts every year and its exact position is hard to tell. It can't leave the gyre since it's confined by the currents. The area is about 2,220 kilometers long by 800 kilometers wide, which is almost three times more than Spain and Portugal combined. What's in the trash vortex, you may ask? It's not a solid mass of floating trash. That's a common misconception. What we find are large and disintegrated plastic objects and particles both on the surface and in the water column below. We can even find particles on the bottom of the ocean. Since plastic never biodegrades, it doesn't break down into natural substances. It does go through a photodegeneration process and splits into ever smaller and smaller parts, which are all still considered plastic. The trash and plastics harm sea life, destroy coastal habitats, and more. Oddly enough, plastic helped give us a better understanding of currents and how long it takes for water to move from one part of the earth to another. In 1992, a crate of rubber ducks left China. There was some sort of accident, and about 29,000 rubber ducks got free and went all over the world following the ocean currents. About 10,000 of these ducks drifted to the north, while the other 19,000 or so drifted south. Ducks made landfall in late 1992 in Indonesia, Australia, and South America. Alaska also got some ducks by 1994, and then again in 1998, 2001, and 2003. By 2003, ducks had made it through the Arctic Ocean and were showing up on the shores of Great Britain, Maine, and the US. Sometimes inadvertent experiments can teach us more than planned research. For our last topic, let's discuss a phenomenon that relates to ocean and atmosphere interactions that has benefited from decades of focused and intentional research. This is the El Niño Southern Oscillation Phenomenon. El Niño is an ocean phenomenon that occurs in the equatorial Pacific. During an El Niño event, the southeast trade winds decrease in strength. This allows warm water that was normally blown across the Pacific Ocean towards Indonesia to stay close to the coast of South America near Peru and Chile. It's called El Niño because it's usually strongest during December and is named after the Christ child for Christmas. It usually happens every 3 to 7 years. The fact that it is not perfectly cyclical makes it hard to predict and understand. We use measurements of pressure changes and reversals in the Pacific to understand when and how the wind patterns will change. We've been able to identify when we've had El Niño events and how strong they are going back to about 1950. The events are marked by abnormal weather patterns, especially for Ecuador and Peru. Cold, nutrient-rich water near the western coast of South America becomes blocked by the warm water, disrupting fish and bird communities essential for South American commercial industries and their economies. The biggest El Niño events on record are the 1982-83 and 1997-98 events, and they caused many weather-related damages all over the globe. For Hawaii, El Niño tends to bring dry winters, and drought is much more likely during El Niño years during the October to March period. There is an opposite phenomenon called La Niña that was discovered and named after scientists started to study the El Niño phenomenon. La Niña events are the opposite of El Niño events. They occur when you have colder than average temperature in the eastern Pacific along the coast of Peru. They have roughly, though not exactly, the opposite weather effects as El Niño. The global weather effects are referred to as teleconnections, whereby changes in the Pacific can have ramifications in all other parts of the globe. During an El Niño year, there's increased precipitation in the central Pacific, but intense drying and droughts in Indonesia and northern Australia. The west coast and southeastern US get wetter. Alaska, India, and parts of Asia see a warming all during northern hemisphere winter. In the northern hemisphere summer, we still see intense drying in the Australia and Indonesian regions and a wetter central Pacific. The west coast of South America, as well as Brazil, sees rising temperatures. The La Niña teleconnections are roughly opposite what you see, with drying in the central Pacific and increased precipitation in Indonesia and Australia in the winter phase, and a wetter and cooler conditions in Asia and India during these La Niña times. That finishes up our lecture on global wind systems and large-scale patterns in the ocean and atmosphere. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for a future podcast. Goodbye.